Hi, everyone. I'm excited to announce that the final chapter of the fanfic is up on Archive of Our Own. The link is in the description. Now onwards. Chapter 22. They land in the Ministry entrance hall. For a moment, nothing happens. Officials continue to go about their day, hurrying from one corridor to the next. Then someone notices Draco, and it's as though the attention of every man and woman is drawn, almost involuntarily, to him and Blaze. One by one, Ministry workers turn to stare, leaning together to whisper, nod, giggle. A young woman points. Draco can feel his face redden, and he has to fight the urge to curl in on himself. All this attention reminds him terribly of the day he was led through the Ministry in shackles to his hearing. How every man and woman turned to look and point, to jeer, to spit at his feet as he passed. How angry the wizarding world was with him, and how excited they all were to see him behind bars, or better yet, kissed. Back then, Harry, in some misplaced sense of gratitude to his mother, had asked the court for Draco to be pardoned. Draco knew, even as the iron chains binding him to his seat fell away, that what had happened there, his release, was not law, but corruption. Harry, with his status of savior, bending the rules for Draco and his parents. There had been something terrible about it, escaping unpunished, something that had been eating at his soul ever since. He'd needed it, he realizes with a start. Needed Azkaban. He was supposed to take his punishment and with it earn his forgiveness, both in the eyes of the world and in his own eyes. Draco can feel his mouth going dry. Of course these people think he's a monster. He'd done terrible things and gone free without so much as a slap on the... Remember our first day of Hogwarts? Blaze asks under his breath, snapping Draco out of his thoughts. What did you say to me? You said... Buckle up, Blaze. The world won't know to adore you if you're staring at your toes. Draco gives out a bark of a laugh, shoots Blaze a relieved grin, and the two of them start across the hall. An old man slips his wand out of his sleeve, trying to be casual about it, and almost immediately, two more men follow suit. Then, the three of them are joined, simultaneously, by so many others that the gesture becomes grotesque, reminiscent of some perverse spectacle, making it seem that the display of hostility was rehearsed by everyone in the room, at some point prior to their arrival. From the corner of his eye, Draco sees Blaze lick his lips, but apart from the small gesture, he gives no other sign of nervousness. It seems that in the time they've been apart, each had learned without the other to contain his emotions. Draco glances at the information booth. Lotta, the Ministry receptionist, is studiously avoiding his eyes. At least her wand isn't drawn, Draco notes with a small wave of relief. Normally he'd stop at the information booth to say hello to her, exchange some banter, ask her if she's ready to leave the Ministry, and join Malfoy Enterprises. Not today, though. Pausing now will only offer space for intervention. The quicker they slip into the maze of Ministry corridors, the less likely they are to be harassed. Clenching his jaw, Draco concentrates on keeping his steps steady and even, keeping his back straight, his head high, his arms natural and loose at his sides. As they reach one of the many branching corridors, a witch steps out in front of them, waving her wand in their faces. She looks to be in her early 50s, her colourful robes painfully out of fashion, as are the round, bejewelled spectacles perched atop her button nose. Maybe, if he pretends to misinterpret her intentions, she will leave them alone. So Draco plasters on his warmest smile, murmurs, "I'm sorry, madam," and tries to sidestep her. "You will leave the Ministry this instant," she snaps, moving with him and raising her wand higher. Draco glances around. "Has the Ministry been closed to the public?" he asks in a polite, curious tone. No Death Eater shall traipse through these halls on my watch. Leave, or I'll call in the aura department, and they'll be escorting you. Kind as the offer of armed escort is, says Draco, I'm sure my companion and I can make it to our meeting safely. The woman sputters, face reddening, then taps his forehead with her wand. The action is so rude that Draco's mouth drops open involuntarily, his eyebrows shooting into his hairline. Madame, says Blaze, I believe you're overstepping yourself. Begone with you, Malfoy, she snaps. If you think I won't lay down my life to keep the Ministry safe from darkness, you've another thing coming. Lotta! She peers between them at the information booth. They're not listening to me. Call in the auras. Tell them the Ministry is under attack. You realize we're not trying to fight you, says Blaze, exasperation starting to color his voice. We're just trying to get to our meeting. Someone laughs, and Draco becomes hyper-aware of the crowd gathering around them, wands raised. He can feel strands of their unfriendly magic licking at the edges of his own, and the proximity itches under his skin. His fingers twitch. Still, he doesn't go for his wand, because even through the mounting fear, he knows that any threatening move on his part will be catastrophic. With a sizzle of spellwork, a door appears in the wall beside the woman. She jumps when she notices it, but then grins, her grip on her wand tightening, stance straightening. The unspeakables are coming, she cackles. They'll take care of you. The door opens, and Draco is relieved to see Granger walk out of it, her dark robes swirling elegantly around her. What's going on here, Doris? She asks, placing a hand on the woman's shoulder. Hello, Draco. Causing quite the ruckus again, I see. You and your companion? She breaks off, takes in Blaze. Zabini? She says on a breath, eyes widening. I was just doing my job, pipes up the woman, drawing Hermione's attention back to herself, protecting the Ministry from a Death Eater attack. I thought your job was to process inner-city portkey requests, says Hermione. It is the duty of every Ministry employee to protect its sanctity. Very brave of you, Doris, says Hermione, but her eyes still haven't left Blaze. She looks mystified. Mr. Malfoy? A pause. Her fist clenches in her robes, releases. Mr. Zabini? She clears her throat. Come, I'll escort you to Warbeck's office. Draco opens his mouth to ask her how she knows where they're going, then closes it. It doesn't matter. The three of them sidestep Doris and head down the corridor. How is it you're alive, Zabini? You're an unspeakable. Aren't you supposed to know everything? Past, present, future, every possible variation. That's not how it works. If it were, we'd be able to avoid a great deal of tragedy as a society. Still, says Blaze, your husband played no small role in the cleanup. Yes, well, Hermione replies with a sigh. I wasn't in the best of places when the cleanup was happening. What does that mean? She starts when. One of the doors in the corridor opens. A lovely little witch walks out of it and promptly screams at the top of her lungs at the sight of Draco. It takes Hermione 5 whole minutes to calm her down enough to send her on her way. This is insane, says Draco, once they're finally alone. I doubt any of these people even thought of me in the last decade, but some stupid article comes out, and suddenly I'm a Death Eater again. Of course you are, says Hermione. You want them to think of you as more than a Death Eater. You need to offer the world something other than a proclivity for dark magic. And how would you go about scrubbing clean my name? Malfoys have been associated with dark magic for generations. Me? Oh, I would have chosen the greater good. I would have put my fellow citizens over my own greed and well-being. That would have probably bought me some goodwill. But you and I are different people. My parents were lords, quite the act of heroism. You speak of compassion for others, for strangers. But if I don't put my own family first, a family that loves me and which I love, how true is my proclaimed goodness? Well, now you have to live with this, says Granger, as a group of interns coming down one of the adjoining corridors jumps upon seeing Draco and scrambles for their wands. You'd do the exact same thing if you were in my shoes. Actually, I obliviated my parents because it was the right thing to do. If choosing the Wizarding World over Voldemort was as simple as obliviating my parents, perhaps I would have done so too. Leaving them to be tortured and murdered, not quite so easy. They wouldn't have been, wouldn't they? She shrugs. Perhaps it is okay to leave people with the consequences of their own choices. Not when they are your family, Hermione. She glances at him then, as if to say, not mine, but maybe yours. Merlin, says Blaise, listen to the two of you. Are you hearing yourselves? What do either of you know about losing family? Who have you lost, Granger? No one. You don't know how Draco felt. Yes, there was always a chance your parents would be targeted if they could be found, specifically because of your association with Potter. But you never, never had to leave them at Voldemort's mercy in order to save the Wizarding World. As for you, he turns to Draco, any sort of judgment or persecution would be worth bearing if it meant my parents were an apparition charm away. I'm sorry, says Draco. You're right, of course you're right. How could you say that? Asks Hermione. Their actions led you straight to Voldemort. You should be angry. I am. And still, I would do it all again, because it's not so simple, my family, as by the sound of it, yours was. Draco turns his face from Hermione. Sometimes parental love nourishes and grows, and sometimes it's both the most wonderful and the most horrible thing one has to live with. Voldemort was simple in comparison. I didn't need to question his intent or his integrity. But my father... Draco runs his hands over his face. I don't want to talk about this. Blaise squeezes Draco's shoulder, and Draco can see in his eyes that he understands. Of course he understands. Blaise is doomed to forever long for loving parents he never truly had, and in some sad and twisted way, so is Draco. Here we are, says Hermione, gesturing to a door with a golden plaque saying Matilda Warbeck. They knock, with a melodious, Enter! The door glides open, revealing an elegant office room. Thick black rugs line the floor, decorated with a pattern of green leaves that reflect the green of the silk wallpaper. In the center of the room stands a lacquered desk with two chairs of black lacquer and gold in front of it. They're paired with a coffee table and three armchairs tucked away in the far corner. Draco examines the room with interest. Warbeck clearly cares about what surrounds her. As Draco enters the office, he sees Hermione grab Blaise by the wrist. I'm glad you're alive, says Hermione. Are you? Asks Blaise, pausing to look at her a moment, then shakes his head and follows Draco through the door. Matilda Warbeck is an elegant dark-haired woman in her late 50s. She's all sharp shoulders and sinuous lines. Her movements are graceful, her smile soft and welcoming. Draco can see, even with their age difference, why Zabini Sr. had found her appealing. After she brushes Blaise's cheek with unreserved tenderness, introductions are made. Draco Malfoy, she says in her melodious voice, giving Draco a winning smile and extending a hand for him to shake. As handsome as your father. Draco takes her hand with both of his, inexplicably grateful for the warm reception. Then again, she is a... what? Mother figure? Mentor? To Blaise. He supposes that it would be odd for her to take the meeting if she had hostile feelings towards him. They exchange meaningless chit-chat. Then she offers them seats around the small coffee table in the corner of her office. It's bare, but for the Daily Prophet lying face down atop it. Ignoring the paper, Draco sits in one of the armchairs, letting his palms run over the luxurious green velvet. "As I'm sure Blaze has already told you," says Draco, leaning forward to rest his elbows on his knees. "We're here to ask you to organize a meeting between us and the Wizengamot." "Yes," she says, a small frown crossing her features. "You're looking to bring peace to wizarding society. I think it's truly wonderful that you've finally taken an interest in current affairs, Draco, and while reconciliation is a lovely idea, unfortunately, after this morning's front-page article," she waves at the Prophet, "a meeting with the Wizengamot is entirely off the table." "Matilda," says Draco, "surely there is something..." "They're afraid of you, Draco. You of all people should understand that." "Nothing of what that article said was true." "I believe you," she says. "And still, I can in no way recommend that the Wizengamot meet with you after something like this." Three delicate gold espresso cups pop into existence. Matilda passes a cup to Draco, then to Blaze, before taking one herself. "Not only will it put my reputation on the line," she goes on, sipping her coffee, "but I will be putting it on the line for no reason. Even if you get in front of them, they won't listen to you." "What can I do?" asks Draco. "How do I fix this?" "You must redeem yourself in the eyes of the people." Draco laughs. "A public pardon and a decade of keeping my head down weren't enough to clear my name." "A very large, very public donation might help," she offers. "That kind of move is always seen as an attempt at manipulation," says Draco dismissively. Matilda shrugs. "Blaze can be the face of the project," says Draco, leaning back in his chair. "No, he can't," says Matilda. "The arrest records for his family are still in the system. Don't forget that what happened to them during the cleanup was ministry sanctioned. It has to be you." "What do you want me to do? I can threaten to sue the Prophet, have them publish a retraction?" Warbeck waves a hand. "That won't do anything. Too many people believe the article, retraction or no." "Draco could publish his own article," says Blaze. "Saying what? I'm a good guy. I don't want to hurt anyone. Or better yet, Weasley is a lying meanie." "Absolutely not." "Actually," Matilda says, lifting her coffee cup to her lips, "that's a rather brilliant idea." "No, there's no way I'm going to give the Prophet access to myself. They'll twist anything I say to their own advantage." "Then find a friendly press. Draco, until this is smoothed over, my hands are tied. But hear this. Today's article escalated a bill the DMLE has been trying to pass for a long time, requiring all Slytherins register with them. Not only that, but they're to wear snake pins outside their homes so that the general public will know whom they are interacting with. Without some sort of intervention, it will be passed at the next Wizengamot hearing." "And when's that?" asks Blaze. "In 9 days." Afterward, Draco leaves Blaze with Matilda and returns to the manor. He doesn't know how long restoring the Zabini records and getting access to the accounts will take, but he's sure it'll keep Blaze tied up for the day. Draco should go to work, check on incoming shipments, but he can't bring himself to face reality just yet. Instead, he wanders the gardens aimlessly. It seems to him he wanders for a very long time, until there, in the perfectly green, manicured bushes, Draco notices a single brown leaf. He parts the branches with a gentle hand and reaches into the bush to pluck it, wincing as a thorn scratches the back of his hand. Then he sees another brown leaf and reaches for it too. Then another and another and another still. Draco is pulling leaves from branches, then tearing them, grabbing them by the handful and dumping them at his feet, only to reach into the bush again. Until both his hands are lined with thin stripes of red, some crisscrossing, some starting to bleed, where the thorns try to thwart his attack on their innards. He doesn't stop until the very last leaf is pulled from the bush, and it's standing there, tortured and bare. And Draco is collapsing, knees hitting the ground, as he lifts fistfuls of green leaves and tries desperately to reattach them to the bush. He doesn't notice when his labored breathing turns into sobs. It seems to him that the bush is shrinking away from him, pulling back, afraid of his touch, afraid of him. He wraps his hand around the trunk and wandlessly forces his magic into it. His head spins with the force of his spell, and the bush shakes, quivering from it. Then leaves, fresh and green and beautiful, burst from the abused branches in a sickening display of life. Panting, Draco places his forehead to the earth, sobbing and begging for something, deliverance or safety. Forgiveness. The kind he knows will never come, and how can it, when in the end all there is to him is this rotting core of darkness and destruction where once there had inhabited a soul. He stays this way for a very long time, until finally the wind picks up and it begins to rain. Exhausted, Draco goes inside the house, climbs the stairs to his room, and sits down on his bed. After a few moments, he realizes that his hands are shaking. Crawling under the covers just as he is, in his wet clothes, Draco curls in on himself and falls into a fevered dream. In the dream, he's standing in a sunlit field. The trees around him are heavy with leaves, flowers spread in a kaleidoscope of color. A butterfly dances in the breeze, another one joins it. A bee darts past Draco's ear, and he turns sharply, following it with his gaze. Beside him stands Voldemort, eyes half closed, head tipped up into the sunlight. It's odd, Draco thinks, how human he can be in simple moments. There's no one here for miles around, except the two of them and the dead body of a muggle man lying at their feet. A gift, Voldemort had called it, a graduation present, though it really is a final exam. "Go on then, boy," says Voldemort, not unkindly, placing a hand on Draco's shoulder. "Don't be afraid. I know you can do it." Draco licks his lips, tucks his fear, his nervousness away. "I'm afraid of hurting you," he says finally. Voldemort just laughs. "No one can hurt me, child. Go on." Draco looks at him out of the corner of his eye, then nods. He glances around the field once more, takes in the perfection, the overflowing beauty of it. Then he draws his wand and begins to cast. It's a slow, complex spell. Green threads of his magic weave in and out of the dead man's body and stitch him into the earth. When Draco's done braiding the intricate pattern, he reaches deeper, deep into the soil, shuddering at the sheer life he finds there. Then he begins to pull. Around him, the grass starts to yellow, the flowers droop, their petals drop, then they wilt, turn to sludge in the brown grass, a gust of wind blows, and Draco and Voldemort are showered in brown leaves, falling from the trees around them. Voldemort's face remains impassive, politely curious, as he watches Draco perform the spell. The dead man jerks, coughs, sits up. Draco doubles over and throws up. "You've done so well, my boy," says Voldemort, wiping a bead of sweat from Draco's brow. "You're feverish, of course you are. It's a difficult spell, this one, but you did so well." Voldemort draws his wand and points it at the man slowly getting to his feet, murmurs, "Avada Kedavra." Nothing happens. The man straightens, turns around to stare at them. "You, Draco Malfoy, have made our army unstoppable." And through it all, the sun continues to shine, as though it doesn't notice the horrors happening beneath its beams. Draco wakes, shaking and sweaty, and stumbles across his room to the table. He pens a letter, just 5 words. "I need to see you," signed, D. Then he goes up to the owlery 2 steps at a time and hands the letter to the first owl he sees, sending her on her way before he gets the chance to reconsider. Harry arrives within the hour.